All right, so, well, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be giving this talk. It would have been better if I was actually physically present, but, you know, strange times, so we got to do what we got to do. So I will talk about recent work with Daniel Zafiris. Our paper came out sometime in September, early September. There are still issues under development, which I will not comment on, but I'm happy to discuss afterwards. And the general broad picture is we want to see the hologram from the inside, from the perspective of an internal bulk observer. Now, this is a question that we don't usually ask in quantum mechanics. Usually when we have a quantum system, we simply describe it from the outside. But you know, ADS-50 provides us with this kind of dual description of the same physics. One of which is the internal description, the description appropriate for a bulk observer. And we would like to learn the rules for switching to that internal perspective. So that's, generally speaking, the goal. And this is not just an academic question. This is a question that's motivated by black holes. We would like to understand, in particular, the black hole interiors. The general question is the following. How can we see, how can we probe the physics behind the black hole horizon? This could be a single-sided black hole formed from collapse, or it could be a two-sided black hole like the one I'm drawing in this figure. The issue with that is that in order to probe the interior, we'll have to send something in. But once we send something in, it never comes out classically. Or quantum mechanically, it will come out, but much later in a very scrambled form. So it's not a useful, so it's difficult to kind of pose precise questions about the black hole interior in this way. However, if one of you decides to get on a spaceship and go to the center of the galaxy and fall inside, you know, you will definitely see something. Your devices will measure whatever they are to measure. So it's an operationally well-defined question. Which we would like to ask, which we would like to know how to ask and how to answer. So in particular, we're interested in very simple questions, like for example, how much proper time passed for this infalling observer until they hit the singularity, or perhaps until they meet some other observer who fell in earlier, or perhaps until they see an excitation that we sent to him from the other side in this two-sided setup. Another related question is if you're carrying a calorimeter or a Geiger counter, did you measure any particles? Did you see any excitations coming your way? And of course, a more refined question is, what are the precise observables that this observer can excite and measure after they cross the horizon? So how can we reconstruct the operators that describe the experience of the observer across in the black hole interior? So these are very general basic questions we would like to ask. Of course, general relativity tells us that we can simply extend the space-time in the interior, but we would like to kind of understand this microscopically from the CFT perspective. How can we probe the interior directly from the boundary without reference to the bulk solution for the space-time? So of course we will, I try to ask this question in the context of ADS-CFT. And from ADS-CFT is a very successful framework for describing black holes, but it's best for describing black holes from the asymptotic frame, from far out in the asymptotic boundary of ADS. And from that distance, the black hole looks like an ordinary quantum mechanical thermal system. It has a finite entropy, it has fast scrambling dynamics, and it's evolving unitarily. So all these things are aspects of black hole physics that have been understood at different degrees of detail. And we also understand how to reconstruct the exterior of the space and how to bridge the gap between the CFT description and the exterior bulk description. But somehow the interior, which is in the future of this bulk Schwarzschild evolution, has remained obscure. It's difficult to construct tools that penetrate a holographic, it's difficult to construct tools that extend the holographic dictionary past that horizon. So the approach we will take in order to kind of penetrate that horizon is to switch to the complementary perspective, to kind of leverage this idea that even though our system, our black hole system, can be described entirely from the CFT on the boundary, in the case of a two-sided black hole, by two CFTs on the boundary, in the case of a single-sided black hole, by one CFT on the boundary, there exists an internal reference frame. So this is the CFT description, two CFTs on the boundary, but there exists an equivalent description from the perspective of the infoiling observer. Namely, there exists some other Hamiltonian which generates the proper time of that observer that falls in the interior, which explicitly accesses the interior. At least that's the expectation from general relativity. So the question is, how do we switch to that perspective? I want to emphasize here that this other perspective is not independent. All the physics we believe is described by the initial state of the CFT or pair of CFTs in this two-sided setup and the dynamics, the Hamiltonian that we chose microscopically on the boundary. Yet there is a reorganization of that information, the same information, that switches to that internal, this infoiling frame description. And we would like to ask, how do we derive the Hamiltonian relevant for the propagation in this observer's frame? So this Hamiltonian, again, it's not something we can choose. We're not free to decide what this Hamiltonian is. It's something to be derived from some set of rules that are yet to be identified. And that's making progress in that end is the goal of this talk. All right. So the rules for constructing this proper time Hamiltonian of any internal bulk observer is roughly speaking what we will try to do. So I don't know how clear the goal is. Hopefully I communicated it. But I want to kind of start before we actually make progress towards answering this question. I want to start by posing a puzzle, something that has puzzled me and Daniel for a while, a puzzling feature of that proper time Hamiltonian, which we will address at the very end. So, and the puzzling feature is the following. It's best formulated in this two-sided setup, although a similar kind of puzzle appears in a single-sided setup as well. So the puzzle is the following. Imagine this two-sided black hole, which we know that is microscopically described by a pair of CFTs, a left and a right, which are decoupled. So dynamically, there's no mixing between the two sides, but they are in a very entangled state called the thermofield double state. So this state describes this short wormhole at this initial time slice. So I can introduce an observer, namely some kind of coherent wave packet on the right exterior simply by acting with a right CFT operator. This is by using the ordinary bulk reconstruction techniques that are unambiguous. But because this is a right CFT operator and because the dynamics, because the two CFTs are dynamically decoupled, no amount of boundary time evolution will ever mix this degree of freedom with the left CFT algebra. So this all right that I used in order to construct my wave packet, will always commute with the left CFT algebra. However, after a finite proper time in the reference frame, namely of the excitation itself, after a finite proper time, the observer will be behind the horizon. And at that point, based on that diagram that I'm drawing over here, I am able to receive signals that I'm sending from the other side. So after a finite amount of proper time, let's call this proper time tau, of by evolving this the degrees of freedom of this guy with the proper time Hamiltonian, after a finite time, this commutator has to be non-zero because of precisely my ability to receive signals from the other side, according to this diagram. So whatever the rules are, that allow us to switch reference frames in this quantum mechanical setup, they will necessarily need to produce a coupling between left and right in this proper time Hamiltonian. So even though the systems are dynamically decoupled, only because of the entanglement present in the original state, our rules for switching reference frames will necessarily have to give us a proper time Hamiltonian that couples left and right. Otherwise, we have this kind of puzzle with the commutator. Is this puzzle clear? So somehow a coupling needs to emerge. Again, not always. You know, we could also have states, for example, that describe really long wormholes, in which case, you know, falling in the interior does not allow you to receive signals from the other side because there's, you know, the wormhole is too long and therefore signals from the left can never reach an observer that falls from the right. So under certain circumstances and for certain states, a coupling between left and right should appear in this proper time Hamiltonian, and we'd like to understand what rules give us that coupling and under what circumstances. All right. So this is the motivation of this work. What are the rules for constructing this proper time Hamiltonian, and can we resolve this little conceptual puzzle about this? This is, by the way, a puzzle first posed by Marlowe and Wall. I think it's implicit in all the ER equals EPR discussions. It's kind of the essence of this entanglement equals connectivity discussions. And it has also been addressed by Benny in various papers, although he reaches conclusions that are not obviously the same as the ones that I will describe here. So this is the motivation. And just to kind of put it in a more general and broad context, it's really a question about a different method for bulk reconstruction, one that does not use the bulk background solution as an input. All reconstructions that we have available right now in general in holography, be it AHKLL or these modular flow reconstructions or PETSMAPs, all these are successful reconstructions, but all of them require at some level as an input the background solution, the space-time on which I'm reconstructing the fields. So what we would like to, what we're essentially asking is for a kind of more universal prescription, a way of probing the bulk that does not rely on inputting the bulk solution. Okay, this is my motivation. I hear no questions so far, so you're on board. I like that. Good. All right, so let me now explain, let me introduce the setup. So I'll spend a few moments on this slide. So we want to somehow learn how to introduce an observer into the system. Now, introducing an observer is a difficult task. You know, there's all sorts of engineering issues to be addressed, but we're not trying to create conscious beings. We're just simply trying to introduce some sort of physical system that we can use as a probe, some sort of idealization of an observer, of a bulk observer. And we'd like to do that in a way that we understand how to do, in a way that is understandable in the CFT. So a nice universal classical probe is a black hole. So we will use a black hole as our observer, as a physical system we use to probe the space-time. So here's how we will do this. We start with a system, the CFT, which describes the universe that we want to probe. And we will introduce another system, the reference system. And we will start the system and the reference in the thermofield double state. What this describes, and for simplicity, we assume that the reference system is a copy of our system. Just for simplicity, it's not necessary. What this thermal field double state describes on the system side is a thermal canonical ensemble, and therefore it describes a static black hole sitting at the center of our system. A very simple setup so far. And then what we will do is that we will act on that thermofield double state with a unitary whose role is the following. First, we use the asymptotic symmetries of this ADS spacetime to shift the black hole out of the way. So we act with a translation operator to move the black hole far out, somewhere close to the asymptotic boundary on the original slice. And then the U system is also allowed to excite the bulk fields and back react and create the whatever spacetime we're interested in exploring. So we will assume that whatever excitations U system introduces are localized at a space-like separation from our black hole in the original, in the initial time slice, which we have, as I said, moved out towards the boundary. So we have introduced our black hole, which is entangled with the reference. We've shifted out of the way and excited the system to create the whatever spacetime we want to probe. And then we evolve the system. So we have started with TFT, acted with the unitary, and then evolve the system. And we obtain some state. And what the state does is it describes the evolution of the black hole in that universe. As long as the black hole is smaller than the features of the universe that we introduced with this unitary, the black hole by the equivalence principle will just simply follow the word line that an ideal observer would follow. And this is what this state describes.
Can I ask a question?
Of course, yeah.
I don't know if that's an issue or so, but I mean, black hole has a bunch of like a huge number of microstates, right? And usually I would expect that, that observers is, can be entangled with your system, but certainly can't be completely entangled with all possible, can't be completely mixed, but only is entangled to like a small subsystem of the world, just because I personally have very few microstates.
Right, this can be a small black hole also, it doesn't have to be a really large one.
Oh yeah, okay, I was just wondering because your system and your reference,
Okay, so
systems are in the same like on a thermal double state. So I don't know how important that.
Well, okay, so let's see. So good. Let me actually take that comment and make a comment that I usually make at this point. But I will kind of shift the question a little bit. The question will be, okay, so how big is this black hole? You're using a thermal field double between the system and the reference. So clearly you're describing black holes in the canonical ensemble on each system, and these are fairly big black holes. In fact, the smaller they can be is the size of the curvature of LADS. So these are cosmological scale observers in a sense. The black hole can be made smaller by using, instead of the thermal field double, by using a microcanonical version of the thermal field double. So instead of using the thermal field double, you just project the thermal field double on a narrower window, a microcanonical window, which has to be fairly big in order to describe a classical spacetime, but it can be made much smaller than the width of the canonical ensemble. And these black holes can actually be made very small. They can be made parametrically smaller than LADS while still be dominating the microcanonical ensemble. So our observer can be made much smaller. There are some subtleties there, which I will not discuss right now, but the size of the observer does not seem to be a limiting factor in this construction. I will use the thermal field double consistently because it's much easier to make all the arguments, but there doesn't seem to be a fundamental obstruction into shrinking our black hole down to parametrically smaller than LADS scales.
Can I also ask a question?
Yes, Ben.
So I'm just wondering, so if you put this probe black hole into another black hole in this setup, will it be a maximally entangled black hole or more like? So my question is, so after doing this, you put thermal field double state, and part of it into the black hole, which is, suppose that one is already like two-sided black hole. then this black hole, is it maximally entangled black hole, or its entanglement is sub the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy?
Okay, so one second. So first of all, let me clarify something. This black hole I'm introducing here is not the black hole I was describing in my motivation slides.
I understand.
This is my probe. This is my definition of the probe. Now, I don't want to go straight to how I would describe throwing this probe black hole into a bigger black hole yet. I want to first kind of explore how to propagate in the frame of that black hole in more simple situations to establish some, you know, some technical understanding of how it works. And then at the end, we'll switch to this question. So if you don't mind me,
keep it up. Okay, that's right. But can I ask one other question? So why do you need a black hole? You could just throw a EPR pair, or you could throw a shockwave, spherical shock.
So yes, you don't need a black hole. I don't think that the black hole is necessary for address. I mean, neither of us is a black hole. So clearly you can have observers who are not black holes. The point of a black hole was, black hole is a very technically convenient probe to use. It's kind of an ideal sort of classical probe. Why? Because A, it's classical. B, it is a particle detector. Whenever something crosses paths with a black hole, it detects the black hole detects the particle because it absorbs it. And the response to that particle is universal. It just simply gets fatter. So you don't have to deal with the engineering problem of, you know, what is your observer coupled to and how do they respond and so on. Another thing is that we know how to introduce how to describe the black hole directly from the boundary. So we don't have to go into the weeds of, you know, engineering and observer. So it's we simply put them in the thermal field double. We know how to do this in the CFD. So it's a very ideal kind of setup for introducing a classical idealized probe of the space-time. So yeah, I would think that a more general discussion can be had, but this is the setup I will focus on.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for the question. That's actually good because many people tend to ask the question, why the hell do you need the black hole? So that's kind of why. Okay, so good. So this is the setup. And now we will describe how to make some progress. So first, let's set our objective straight. We want to propagate fields, bulk fields, along the world line of the black hole. Now, we don't want to propagate everything in the universe. We will focus on operators that live near the black hole. So we will call them the atmosphere operators. The atmosphere operators is this set of operators that lives in this kind of little green tube around my black hole. The precise size of the tube doesn't really matter. The point is that you're focusing on near horizon operators, operators that are close to the black hole. Intuitively, it's the degrees of freedom that the observer can measure or manipulate directly. You don't have access to the entire universe at every given moment in time. You simply have access to your neighborhood, and that kind of motivates us looking at these operators. So, so we will construct, we will start with the set at the initial slice. There will be a set of simple local operators living in the atmosphere of the black hole. We will call this set S of T for, you know, the set appropriate for the time T. And it's important to remember, because these are operators that are, these are operators, bulk operators in the theory of gravity, we have to dress them somehow. We have to explain how they're framed. Because we're interested in observables in the frame of the black hole, we will dress them to the local horizon. So at any given moment, at any given point along the world line, there's a little ABS Schwarzschild frame around my black hole, which is the analog of the local inertial frame of the ideal observer. So we will place these guys, we will label them by their location in this local ABS Schwarzschild frame around the black hole horizon. So in a Penrose kind of diagram, if this is my T equals zero, I will kind of define the location of these operators from the geodesic distance from the local horizon. if the black hole absorbs something and then the horizon shifts, then the new operator is addressed with reference to the new horizon, and so on. So that's kind of, this is the framing I will use for my operators. Okay, and then of course, you know, if I have, if I go back to this figure here, if I start with a set of operators at this t equals zero, let's call it slice, and then clearly the unitary that relates these operators to these operators will be precisely the proper time evolution. So having access to the set of operators at the initial slice and the final slice, the unitary that relates it is the proper time evolution, and it's precisely the object that we're interested in learning how to construct. All right, this is the setup. Now we will focus on learning how to build this object. And the concept that we will use, we'll make heavy use of, is the modular Hamiltonian, of the system. So remember that we started, the setup is a state psi, which is an entangled state between the system and the reference. After I trace out the system, I'm sorry, the reference, I obtain a reduced density matrix for the system. And then the modular Hamiltonian is defined as minus the logarithm of this reduced density matrix. And in this kind of, in this class of states that I'm using, which are obtained by a unitary transformation of the thermal field double, that modular Hamiltonian will always be unitarily equivalent to the dynamical Hamiltonian of the system. The reason for that is perhaps obvious to everyone. The thermal field double describes the reduced state on the system. The thermal field double is the thermal, the canonical ensemble, is this thermal state. The modular Hamiltonian for that is the Hamiltonian of the system. After the unitary transformation, we simply unitarily conjugate the Hamiltonian of the system. All right. So this Hamiltonian, this modular Hamiltonian, will be important in our construction for the following reason. Roughly speaking, it will be the seed of the generator of that proper time evolution V that I talked about in the previous slide. It won't be the generator of this proper time evolution, but it will be the seed, and everything, the generator will be defined with reference to that modular Hamilton. It's important to note at this point already that this modular Hamiltonian depends on the initial state of the universe that we have and the type of probe that we introduced. So it's kind of an intrinsic property of the probe in the given state that we inserted it in. Okay. So let me now already give you a first hint for why this modular Hamiltonian is relevant for this discussion of the proper time evolution along the black hole's water line. So for that, let me just talk about the simplest case, the case where the black hole propagates along some water line in the space time I created, but nothing gets absorbed in the way. The journey of the black hole is undisturbed. So there are no infalling particles. It's an assumption. That's not a general case, of course. We will reserve the general case for, we will talk about this in a moment. But in that simple situation, again, remember, we're looking for the unitary V that relates the initial atmosphere operators to some final atmosphere operators. But in the situation with no infalling particles, the geometry around my black hole is always approximately Schwarzschild or ADF Schwarzschild in the neighborhood of the black hole. The atmosphere state is also approximately thermal because there are no particles disturbing the journey of my black hole by assumption. And there's no infalling energy, which means that the horizon doesn't shift along the way. But by these three assumptions, this means that as far as correlation functions of the atmosphere operators are concerned, the initial and late time atmosphere of the black hole is identical, is indistinguishable. Correlation functions of the late time atmosphere operators and the early time atmosphere operators are exactly the same. Again, because they only sense the surrounding, the atmosphere of the black hole itself, in which the state is exactly the same. As a result of this, whatever that unitary is, whatever this unitary V is, it'll have to be a modular symmetry, at least when acting within these correlation functions. Modular symmetry means symmetry of the state. But to be more precise, we have to make a clarification. So you think of, if psi is my background state, you think of the little Hilbert space that you construct by acting on that background state with this atmosphere operators phi. This is a small subspace of the full Hilbert space that you can explore. So within this subspace, we have this property, and therefore V, the proper time evolution, will have to be generated by operators which are zero modes of the state projected onto the subspace. Symmetries of the state projected onto the subspace. This is exactly what this equation here says. So the generator of this V of H will have to be generated by the zero modes of the modular Hamiltonian within of the projected modular Hamiltonian on that subspace that we can explore with the atmosphere fields. Of course, one zero mode is the modular Hamiltonian itself because it commutes with itself, but there could be other zero modes, like for example, rotating the black hole about its axis and so on. So in this simple setup, we see that the generator of the proper time evolution is the modular Hamiltonian plus other modular zero modes of this type. And the claim that I will explain a little bit in a bit more detail later on is that the coefficient of the modular Hamiltonian appearing in this unitary is the proper time. So I will postpone this discussion for a little bit, but this is the claim in this case. So I hope this kind of illustrated semi-convincingly why in the case where my black hole propagates undisturbed, then the unitary relating the unitary describing the evolution of the atmosphere operators along the world line is necessarily a modular symmetry and therefore generated by the modular zero modes, things that commute with the projected modular Hamiltonian. I have not explained that part, the physical interpretation of that coefficient. I will do so in a little bit. I'm happy to get questions, but I'm also happy to continue, so I'll leave it up to you. So this is the first hint, a first glimpse of how to generate that proper time evolution, but it's not the final word. And this is the final, well, not the final word, but a more final word. This is the main claim of the paper and of the talk. So let me now kind of take this toy example of no infalling particles we just discussed and kind of make the main claim, and then we will justify the various things that I say. So the statement is the following. Let V be that unitary that relates the atmosphere operators at two different moments in time. H here stands for the fact that I'm representing it in the structure, and I take the logarithm of it because I'm interested in constructing its generator. The statement is the following. The right-hand side of this equation is a decomposition of that logarithm into eigen operators of the modular Hamiltonian K. Now, this part over here is the part that we just discussed. It's the eigenoperators with eigenvalue zero. Namely, they are operators. So eigenoperators means, of course, that if G of lambda is an eigenoperator, this means that after I commuted with K, I get lambda times G for some lambda. So this part over here, the K and the other zero modes, are the eigenoperators with lambda equals zero. And we just discussed why they appear. Now, there's another class of eigenoperators that appears according to our claim in this setup. And these are the eigenoperators where lambda, this eigenvalue, is imaginary with a positive imaginary part. These guys if you evolve them with modular flow, they grow exponentially in time, in modular time. In fact, there is actually, the appearance of these guys in these situations, in these generators, are actually constrained by a result that Jan de Boer and I derived back last year, following some previous work by Tom Faulkner, Huazhou Wang, and Min Li. And the argument is that this imaginary part, kappa squared, can be at most equal to 2 pi in an appropriate or normalization in an appropriate set of normalization conventions. This means that the contributions, the modular weights that can appear in this expansion cannot grow, have an upper bound, and the upper bound is this 2 pi. Let's call these guys scrambling modes. So they have a very simple physical interpretation. Let me give you some intuition. If my black hole was a static black hole, where the modular Hamiltonian is simply the dynamical Hamiltonian, these scrambling mode guys, these things that grow exponentially under time evolution, are simply class of localized average null energy operators at the horizon. The generators of shifts along the two horizons. The reason why these things grow exponentially is simply because of the Poincaré algebra between the boost action of the Hamiltonian close to the horizon and the shift action of these average null energy operators along the horizon. Of course, if I excite the state and it's not just the Hamiltonian, the scrambling modes are different operators, but they have the same kind of interpretation. They're shifts in the frame of the black hole, and it's precisely these guys appearing over here. Okay, so far I made the statement that okay, let me actually complete this. The statement is that the coefficient of these scrambling modes appear in the generator if and only if there's infalling matter. If matter gets absorbed along the way, then these scrambling modes appear as contributions to the generator. The coefficient of these scrambling modes depends on the energy distribution of the infalling energy. So when we have no infalling particles, proper time evolution is simply modular flow. When infalling particles are present, when my black hole detects particles, then the generator acquires an extra contribution. This scrambling mode contribution gets turned on with a coefficient that depends on the energy distribution. I have not explained that statement. I'm simply stating it at this point, and I will describe it in a bit. Everything else is hidden in here, either suppressed in 1/n or decaying exponentially in proper time because they are controlled by the quasi-normal modes in the black hole atmosphere. So the point is that the proper time evolution, this proper time evolution can be a complicated mess, but for as long as we wait at least a couple of thermal times after the last absorption of the particle, the only two persistent effects that are relevant for the propagation are the modular flow and the scrambled mode flow. And these are the two persistent effects. You can, for people who are familiar with this quantum chaos discussions, the appearance of the scrambling modes may be kind of intuitively clear. The point is that when I absorb particles, my black hole gets fatter. As a result of this, the horizon gets shifted outwards. And therefore, the appearance of the scrambling mode, which is precisely the generator of that null shift, is precisely to implement the right Shapiro delays relevant for moving the horizon of the black hole appropriately. We'll discuss this in more detail soon, but just to give you a glimpse of where these things come from. It's precisely adjusting the location of the horizon due to infalling matter.
So what would the exponentially suppressed terms correspond to physically?
All the non-local stuff that the modular flow introduces. You know, people often say that modular flow is not a geometric flow in general. If you have a, and it's true, it will have non-local contributions. But the point is that all these non-local effects introduced by modular flow decay in a modular time as a result of the fact that they simply get absorbed by the black hole. Namely, they decay because of the quasi-normal decay. So the only two persistent effects in the end, in the long modular time limit, but not too long, but in the long modular time limit, the only two persistent effects in this case is modular flow and the scrambling mode contribution. And everything else is exponentially suppressed. Okay, so I want to draw attention to an important feature of this equation here, because this is the main claim. Now I have some explanations of the statements I made and then comments on the black holes. We will get to it, I want to draw attention to an important feature of this, and let me clear this up a little bit. The important feature of this is that these contributions here are defined, are intrinsic properties of the probe. We have the modular Hamiltonian of the system after we traced out the reference that we entangled our probe with. And then we have operators defined with reference to that modular Hamiltonian, namely the eigenoperators, the eigenmodes of that modular Hamiltonian. So in expressing this, this unitary V of H, which relates proper time, which relates atmosphere operators at different locations along the word line, by expressing it in this way, I'm making a background independent, if you will, statement of how to propagate things along the word line. I'm giving you a prescription for how to construct that generator directly in the CFT without reference to the bulk. Up to the subtlety that of this coefficient over here, which so this is not 100% true. Let me get back to this subtlety later on. The point is that this expansion is in terms of operators that are defined with reference to the probe and the initial state only and not with anything else, except for this function, which is the energy distribution to be observed. So it's universal in this way. This expansion is universal in this way, within its regime of validity. Okay. This was the main claim. A few explanations. First of all, I did not explain. So what I haven't explained is why the physical interpretation of, I haven't explained the physical interpretation of these two coefficients. I explained why this K appears, why the zero mode appears. I made a hint for why this thing appears, but I haven't explained the physical interpretation of this as a proper time and this as measuring the energy distribution. So my goal now is to kind of give you some intuition for why this is so. So let's focus first on the proper time issue. Why is the coefficient of the modular flow measuring proper time along the word line? Well, the first statement is that the modular Hamiltonian, this is a slide that talks a lot, but the point of the slide is to make the point that the modular Hamiltonian acting close to the black hole horizon acts like a Schwarzschild boost. Now, I'm explaining why this is so here, but let's skip all the details and just get to the point. And believe me that the modular Hamiltonian acting close to the horizon acts like a Schwarzschild boost. So with that as a given, the reason why this measures proper time along the trajectory of the ideal observer is the following. Well, let's start with the case of the ideal observer, namely the Warland, the probe of GR. If we focus in the neighborhood of the observer's Warland at some given time, the neighborhood looks approximately flat. And what this means is that you have a set of local Killing vectors that form the Poincaré algebra. And one of these Killing vectors preserves the Warland is, we call it the proper time, the generator of proper time. So we don't have this ideal observer, we have a black hole propagating along the corresponding Warland, but we can think of this black hole spacetime as follows. We simply choose a tube around the Warland of the ideal observer, we remove the inside and glue inside the spacetime of the black hole. So we draw a tube over here, we remove the inside and then we glue the black hole. And the gluing happens so that right at the boundary, the size of the transverse sphere is continuous. So R plus and R minus are glued together. And then the local Killing isometry of the original spacetime, namely the proper time, is glued continuously to the local time-like Killing vector of the black hole. And therefore the Schwarzschild time, which as I said, was generated by modular time, is correlated with the proper time of the ideal observer. And that's precisely why modular flow keeps track of the proper time clock of the ideal observer. That may have been too fast. If you want the details, you can refer to the paper. But this is why the coefficient of modular Hamiltonian and proper time are where the connection comes from. And this is not just, I think it's useful to point out that, you know, I'm making formal arguments, but you can see it explicitly at work. You can construct some simple examples of black hole probes in, you know, pure ADS, introduce some kind of sloshing black hole, you know, put a black hole at the center of ADS and give it some rapidity and let it propagate along the geodesic. This setup kinematically is trivial. And you can, of course, perform the procedure that I just described. You can write down explicitly the initial atmosphere operators and the final atmosphere operators. And you can see that the unitary that relates them, once expanded in this eigenbasis of the modular Hamiltonian, the coefficient of the modular Hamiltonian is precisely the, you know, the proper length of that word line that you would compute using geometric means. This was an inertial black hole in motion. But you can also do the same thing for accelerating black holes, or in the other, or perhaps you know, black holes moving in a weakly curved ADS spacetime. So you can consider these trajectories and kind of consider situations where you kick them along the way and perform the same procedure. We do that in the paper, and you can see that it just works. Once you express that unitary that relates the operators along this accelerated word line. Once you express that unitary in terms of the modular flow, you can see that the right proper time comes about. So there are situations where we can explicitly check that this thing is not just fantasy, it works. But I will not comment on that in detail. Okay, so far I have spent some time explaining where the modular Hamiltonian part of the generator of that proper time, why it appears and why its coefficient has a physical interpretation of proper time evolution, of proper time along the Warland. What I haven't explained is where this other contribution comes from, this scrambling mode, and what's the interpretation of the of its coefficient. So let's now talk a little bit about this, because this is important. So the essence is that our black hole is a black hole serves as a particle detector, as I mentioned in the beginning. When a particle falls in, it simply grows larger. So the situation we have in mind here is that we start at some initial time, t equals zero. Phi naught is some atmosphere field in the initial time slice. But now we have included some unitary excitation in the initial time slice, which introduces particles that are bound to fall in the black hole. Particles are this over here, this wavy line. So the point is that when the particles get absorbed, the black hole gets a little larger. And we know pretty well by now that in order to glue this fatter black hole onto the thinner black hole spacetime, one has to do that by introducing a relative null shift between the horizons of the two black holes. This null shift comes in many names. I will use the name Shapiro delay. This null shift can be space, can have a non-trivial spatial profile. The spatial profile of the null shift is determined by the energy distribution of the shell that falls in. This is a property of the gluing that happens. Of course, you know, it's not true that the black hole discontinuously, you know, this gluing is an approximation to the dynamics of this black hole, to the absorption of matter from the black hole, but we will work within that approximation of the back reaction.
Excuse me, can I ask a question?
Of course, yeah.
So actually, what is this wavy line? Where is the probe black hole in this figure? I got
confused. Oh, this is the probe black hole. Oh yeah,
which one? Sorry, which one is the?
So good. Let me clarify this. So remember, our system was a reference and a black hole in space-time that we're using as a probe. So this left side here is the reference, and the
this Penrose diagram is the probe black hole.
The entire diagram is the probe.
Black hole. Oh, okay, yeah, sorry, good.
Yeah, thanks. I could have clarified this. This is simply then, probe black hole. There's no second black hole.
Yeah. Okay, then this wavy line is the particle that.
So far we have discussed, at length how if there are no infalling particles, how proper time evolution is simply modular flow. Mm-hmm. So here I just want to explain how it works when there are particles that fall inside my probe black hole during its journey through spacetime.
Okay.
This is the system black hole. Thanks for the question. And this is some just silly particle that's flying around and gets absorbed. Good. So the point here is that because of the back reaction of this infalling particle, the horizon gets shifted outwards. And this means the following. Because my atmosphere fields are dressed to the local horizon, the early atmosphere fields, you know, may be at some geodesic distance from this bifurcated horizon over here, but the late atmosphere fields that comes with the same labeling will be at the same geodesic distance from the new horizon, which is now separated, which is now shifted relative to the original horizon. So this means that the proper time evolution, this V of H that we're looking to reconstruct, needs to, at first, you know, before the matter shell falls in, needs to propagate us along this hyperbolic trajectory. But after the shell, you know, there's some transient effects around the shell. But after the shell, it acquires overall a shift and it continues boosting us in a way that preserves geodesic distance from the new location of the horizon. Okay, so this is what these V of H need to do. And therefore, whatever construction I present, you must do precisely that. So in the case of no infalling particles, proper time, this V of H was simply generated by that modular Hamiltonian K. But in this case, this fails. And let me explain how it fails and how it's fixed. It fails because you know, you can construct this modular float guy, just simply take the initial atmosphere operator and modular evolve it to the future. And this looks something like this. And you can ask, if I act with that operator on the state, on the, my background state, do I actually get a sense of, is the state I obtain the state the same, like namely does have an order one overlap with the state I would get if I acted with the actual proper time evolved guy on the final state? So is this state, the modular flow guy, the same as the states or close to the state I would obtain by the true geometric proper time evolution? Well, you can simply plug it in and you can see that actually this is not true. In fact, the overlap between the modular float state and the proper time evolved state, it goes to zero for times that are much larger than the thermal time. And that's because this overlap is an out of time order correlation function when you write it out, where this, it's an out of time order correlation function because this phi of t is up here and this u is down here. So as the longer I want to propagate in the future, the worse, the more this modular flow and the proper time evolution deviate from each other. But the deviation, we know exactly how to construct. This overlap is in fact given by this two-point function with a relative null shift. So let me, instead of writing equations, let me just focus on this diagram. The point is the proper time evolution needs to propagate along this trajectory, as I explained. But modular flow seems to propagate us along this trajectory, which always preserves the geodesic distance from the bifurcated horizon. So to bridge the gap between the two, I simply have to shift, correct my modular flow by the appropriate contribution that introduces that extra null shift to fix the location of my atmosphere fields. So, and this can be done. The way to do this is to add this scrambling mode contribution. I want to explain why. It's just true. And you can check the paper for why, maybe you can already see it. And this brings us to the main claim. I explained, or at least attempted to explain all the ingredients in this formula, the modular Hamiltonian, the scrambling mode, and the physical interpretation of these two coefficients, capturing the generator of this proper time evolution in this holographic setup. Okay. Good. So having done so, let's try to now, okay. So we have obtained a way, a framework for addressing the experience of the an internal observer, how to propagate things along an internal trajectory. So let's now try and get back to the original problem we had in mind, the problem of a guy who we throw inside a two-sided black hole. So can we learn anything from it? So again, we start with here, we have two CFTs decoupled in the thermofield double state. And we want to introduce an observer on the right. Let's simply apply the rules that we identified. What we have to do is choose a subsystem of the right and entangle it with a reference. How would we do so? How would we do that? Well, we won't do it in detail like we did in this previous setup, but roughly speaking, any procedure of that type will look like this. We have the thermofield double between left and right CFT and some reference state of the reference. And then we act on that state with some unitary that couples the right CFT and the reference. Oh, here is some operator. I'm not being explicit here, but roughly speaking, you should think of OR as some shell of matter that will collapse to form my black hole on the right. my probe black hole on the right. Of course, for obvious reasons, I won't make this precise right now. But any operation that introduces a probe black hole entangled with the right will look like this, formally speaking. The important thing is to notice that this unitary does not affect the left. Commutes with everything on the left. Okay, so now we have managed to make the first step in our approach, in our procedure, introduce the observer. Now, how will we propagate along this observer world line? How will we propagate, let's say, a field phi in its atmosphere along this trajectory and into behind the horizon? We'll trace out the reference and obtain the modular Hamiltonian my system, system here being the combination of left and right, and use that modular flow to propagate. Well, okay, so modular flow here will be proper time flow. And the observation that we found noteworthy is that because of the pre-existing entanglement in the thermofield double state, this modular flow couples left and right, does not preserve the right algebra. By right, I mean the right, you know, it's an instruction of the direction of right, not the correct. Does not preserve the right algebra, mixes right and left. Which means that within our set of rules, accept for now the rules I suggested for what it means to propagate in proper time or in the proper time of an internal observer. Within these rules, the right coupling expected in this thermofield double setup for the observer to be able to detect an excitation that I may send from the left is there. The coupling appears. So you can think of this as a resolution of the puzzle I mentioned in the beginning, or you can think of it as an extra piece of evidence for why the rules I suggested may actually be correct. Of course, it would be very interesting to make this a much more explicitly precise. Here I'm making a formal argument, which is correct, but it would be nice to kind of see this at work in detail. And there is an ongoing project currently for making this explicit. And there are some preliminary results, and you can try to perform exactly this procedure in SYK. And you can see that this modular Hamiltonian of this internal observer contains the so-called size operator introduced by C and Streicher. And this size operator, roughly speaking, is dual to the sum of these two average null energy operators at the black hole we're trying to probe. And these are things that couple left and right. So this modular Hamiltonian precisely contains the right geometric coupling in this case. Of course, these are preliminary things, and work needs to be done here. And it's an interesting direction. But at the conceptual level, the appearance of this dynamical coupling in the internal frame is not a mystery if you accept the rules I gave you.
Is there a quick way to see. So if I jump into a black hole, I'm on the right-hand side, I jump into the black hole, then the modes from the left system should only become important to me once I've crossed the horizon, right? Is there like a quick way of sort of seeing this in your expansion of the...
There is. There is, but it would be best. So, okay, there is. A nice way of kind of seeing that is to back up from this setup a little bit, and because right now I don't have an explicit modular Hamiltonian to evolve, to actually kind of address this question you're asking. A nicer setup where you can see this explicitly is the case where instead of throwing a black hole inside a bigger black hole, like I'm trying to do here, you just simply consider a Rindler wedge decomposition of pure ADS, where you send the black hole from the right Rindler wedge. There, you actually have all the quantities that you need, and you can explicitly write down this process. And there, you can explicitly write down the modular flow of the original atmosphere operators along the black hole's trajectory, and you can see exactly the horizon crossing there. We actually described this calculation in our discussion of our paper. I did not include it in the slides, and I don't think that it's worth going through this in detail, but yes, you can. There you can see it exactly. Yeah, we have to introduce many things right now. I'm happy to discuss about this after the talk, if you want, but yes, the point is you can see this in the setup explicitly. Yeah.
Okay, cool, thanks.
Can I ask one quick question? So do you mean that, so here the size operator couples two sides of the black hole, does it mean that in order for this picture to work, two sides needs to be actually coupled in your analysis?
It's important to clarify this. So we have not altered the dynamics of the CFT.
Mm-hmm.
What we're doing is that we introduced the probe by entangling a subsystem of the right CFT with the reference. And then we simply took the rules I suggested as given, because they work in these simpler setups, and considered the modular flow of my atmosphere algebra. Now, of course, this is a different way of evolving the state, but if you accept the rules that the right way of propagating in this internal time is by using this modular flow plus scrambling mode contributions, as I explained, then the resolution, the statement is that this rule resolves the puzzle. Namely, accepting that rule gives you the right dynamical coupling when the left and right CFT are entangled sufficiently. That's kind of the statement.
Okay.
So this evolution does contain the right coupling. It's not, but we derived it from the set of rules that I tried to advocate for. So if you accept that this is how we change reference frames in quantum mechanics, then this puzzle is resolved by the rules. Of course, you may ask, maybe you inputted the answer by the set of rules, and that's fair. But you have to start somewhere, and we identified the rules that seem to work in simple situations, and they are consistent with the expectation of the diagram. So this is a good point.
But I don't know if I should ask further questions right now or not, but you could, for example, save this observer and ask her if she has seen the signal from the other side or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then it's actually possible to save an observer from a right-hand side operations only. Doesn't it suggest that she shouldn't be able to see the signal from the other side of the black hole? That's one objection I would have. And the second objection is that if we think about the back reaction from the probe black hole itself, then these modes from the other side is no longer a partner mode of the outgoing radiation.
Mm-hmm.
So this EL, EPL story just simply breaks down. So we don't have any strong reason to think that this Tenros diagram as it's written is correct, especially when something enters inside a black hole, there is a strong back reaction and So many things breaks down. So I agree that if you are the right size operator coupling in SYK or in a generic setting, like traversable wormhole coupling, we can effectively eliminate such back reactions and then try to make sense of this meeting phenomenon. But I think we can discuss later.
Okay, yeah, so I'm happy to discuss in detail. As a quick answer to the two issues you raised, so I'll start from the second. It's unclear to me why, when I have a probe, when I introduce this physical system as my observer, of course, mm-hmm. this will have its own back reaction, but its back reaction is relevant for anything that I will send afterwards, right? You know, I don't mm-hmm. propagate a physical excitation in its own back reacted geometry. I propagate it in the background geometry. And then it's back, whatever back reaction this causes is relevant for everything else. So I would say this diagram I'm drawing is relevant for the propagation of my probe. Of course, after the black hole falls, after my probe black hole falls into the right black hole has gotten a little bit bigger as seen from any later excitations I will send in. But it doesn't mean that I should propagate my probe black hole in the fatter black hole spacetime that I would get after my probe black hole falls inside, right? So I don't necessarily agree with this back reactive picture as relevant for the experience of the probe itself. It's relevant for everything else I will send afterwards, but not for the probe. As far as the first part, I introduced here an observer by exciting a right CFT subsystem and entangling it with the left. And then I simply used as a rule that the right way of propagating in that observer's frame is the modular flow associated to the system after I trace out the reference. If you take this as a choice of a rule, then this choice simply contains a coupling between left and right. Now you may object to identifying the modular Hamiltonian of the system as the proper time generator. And for that, the only answer I have is that it seems to work in situations where the reconstruction is unambiguous, namely pure ADS and weakly curved ADS. And it's kind of natural from some, you know, philosophical perspective. So I see it as a possible, I believe that it's probably, you know, part of the answer, but at least it's plausible. It works, it gives the right geometric answers in setups where we know how to do everything. So seems to be giving you the right a coupling between left and right, resolving that tension between the decoupled CFTs and the connected diagram. And therefore, I see it as plausible. Of course, happy to discuss in detail, more refined objections to this picture.
Yeah.
I just want to end with the fact that this was a case of emergent time. Internal time. We could have, for example, done the everything we said didn't really require the external Hamiltonian. Not everything, but we could have done exactly the same procedure within a given Wheeler DeWitt patch of ADS, dual to just some fixed state on the boundary, and we could have asked the question about the experience of an observer propagate within that Wheeler DeWitt patch. Namely, how to propagate degrees of freedom from that point of its world line to that point of their world line. There, we don't really make use of the dynamics, but everything I said can be formulated in exactly the same way. A modular Hamiltonian exists and it allows you to propagate things in proper time. So it's a kind of an internal notion of time, one that emerges from the correlations of my system and its environment. So it's it's worth asking the question: is this part of a bigger truth, or is it like a curiosity in the case of ADS CFT? I don't know. I want to hope that it's part of a bigger truth. We'll find out. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Lampros. Question time. I mean, we've had a bunch of questions along the way, but I think now, in retrospect, there might be some more. Questions.
I have a question.
Yeah, of course.
You're mainly looking at black holes that are dual to thermofield double state, and you're looking at what the observer sees when they fall into that. What if you considered something like the thermofield double with a bunch of maybe operators acting on it? So you can think of preparing a black hole in a thermofield double state and then throwing a bunch of stuff in it, mm-hmm. and then asking whether if someone falls into that black hole at a much later time, whether they would experience some sort of firewall or something.
Excellent.
So how does your good. Prescription?
That's a great question. Thank you. Because this question allows me to address an issue that is still outstanding with the proposal. And I kind of tried to mention it at some point, but it was bad timing. So the issue is the frozen vacuum problem. So let me explain what that means. What this means is that in this proposal I just described, I can detect excitations that I will send in the black hole from the left by exciting. So I can detect excitations that I will introduce on top of my thermal field double from the left. What this means is that I use the thermal field double to obtain the modular Hamiltonian I will use for the proper time flow. And then I excite the states and then I can detect excitations on top of the thermal field double. What I cannot detect with this current formalism is excitations already present in the state I used to obtain this modular K. So if I first construct the state with the unitary acting on the left, introducing all the stuff that you want to introduce, and for that, and you use that state to obtain this K, the modular Hamiltonian, then you will not detect these excitations if you propagate with these rules. But if you use the thermal field double as the reference to obtain the modular Hamiltonian, and then you act with this unitary that introduces stuff, then you will detect. So this, of course, is a problem, clearly. You would like to be able to diagnose excitations present in the state you use to obtain the modular Hamiltonian. This is a problem that is actually intrinsic to many entanglement-based reconstructions. All reconstructions based on modular flow and you know, this Papadimos-Razou proposal for the interior, all these proposals at some point run into the same problem of the frozen vacuum, of the fact that you need to choose the reference frame, the reference state with respect to which you do your reconstruction, and then you can detect excitations on top of that reference state. So clearly this is something to be resolved. Daniel and I are discussing about this, and Jan is in some conversations, Jan de Boer is involved in some conversations as well. It's an important thing to be squared, to kind of account for in this proposal. There are ideas, but I cannot comment on the final resolution of this. Ultimately, I agree this is an important element to be introduced. At this point, we simply want to resolve the conceptual puzzle of the connectivity. In what sense can I ever detect anything from the left? And this is the part that I claim to have made some progress in. The frozen vacuum is a very important problem, and it will be a major leap in our understanding of the interior.
Okay, thank you.
All right, some more questions.
Can I ask?
Yeah, of course.
In this last slide, when you see the time emerges from observer environment entanglement, am I wrong if I see that in the case when you don't have any infalling particles, that the environment you're referring to is just the reference system you trace out?
Yeah, that's right. The environment I'm referring to here is the reference system that I use to tag my observer. But that's another good question. You guys have great questions today. It's a good question because you may ask, okay, well, it's not true that you shouldn't need to always tag your observer with an external reference, right? So somehow the way, and it's not conclusive, but my view of this reference, entanglement with a reference, is a device. It's a convenient device for describing the for tracing out the microstructure of the observer themselves. So every observer has a set of, you know, microstates that describe them. You don't observe those, right? So you kind of trace them out. You kind of, so this existence of this reference that I entangle with my system, I view it, and perhaps this is how it should be viewed, as a way of effectively tracing out the microstructure of the observer themselves. So this reference should really be, you know, part of my system. Perhaps, you know, all the degrees of freedom that you're entangled with and you kind of, you know, trace out, or all the microstates that describe you and you don't take it into account in your description of the world. So perhaps that's kind of how you should think of this in a more realistic setup. Right now, this is kind of a toy, idealized device for capturing that aspect. All that matters is that So the idea is that after tracing out the observer from the system, you obtain a mixed density matrix for the rest. And that mixed density matrix is kind of what gives you that modular Hamiltonian I'm interested in. That would be my tentative answer to this question. It's an interesting question, how you would formulate it more properly within a given system.